Our subject this afternoon is the barrier of Ellen White's, provided by Ellen White's employment of the use of literary assistants in her writing operation. This has been a problem to a lot of people, sometimes because of a misunderstanding regarding certain theological truths and ideas. The good lady had a staff of paid and often unpaid volunteers who worked with her over the years. The staff was more in the latter part of her career than it was at the beginning, where she had individuals that would come and help. Her husband was the very first one, that literary helper that she had, and we'll talk about him in a minute. But the very existence of this body of helpers has created questions, possibly unnecessarily, but still created questions. And when people have questions, they deserve answers, and they deserve honest and logical, sensible answers, which we're trying to give. And some people have raised the issue, well, if Ellen White had to have a literary helper, how could she be a prophet? Because prophets don't need literary helpers. Well, what's the assumption behind that? The assumption is that God dictates his message to the prophets, and the prophet just is really sort of a cosmic stenographer, you know, and takes down whatever God says word for word. And then, well, if that's the case, then do prophets need literary helpers? And so it's a misunderstanding. If you want to find out, because there are really three basic views on this theological question of inspiration, revelation. First of all, there is the view held by some, even some in our church, that it's called the verbal mechanical view, that the prophet was simply a stenographer taking dictation from God. Well, that wasn't how it was with Ellen White, and that wasn't how it was with the Bible writers, as we'll notice in just a moment. So the second view is the view Ellen White had. We call it plenary view of inspiration, and that is that the men were inspired by God and wrote as they were moved by the Holy Spirit, as Peter says in one of his epistles. In other words, thought inspiration. God gives messages and ideas and thoughts, and then the prophet may well write them down in his own words, or maybe, as we noticed yesterday, use the words of somebody else. And there is a third view, which has crept into some parts of Adventism, which is called the Neo-Orthodox view, and that is a very subjective view of inspiration. I won't even try to get into it here now, but there are some who have adopted that. But if you want to know what Ellen White thought about this question of inspiration revelation, the easiest and quickest place to go is Selected Messages, Book 1, Chapter 1, page 15 to page 23. That is the most concise statement I have ever found in any theological book on the subject of inspiration and revelation. A number of years ago, Raoul Dederin, who was one of our veteran teachers at the seminary, a terrific man, a powerful teacher and preacher, Raoul Dederin, who was a native of Belgium, was invited to go to Switzerland to meet with the World Council of Churches. They were discussing inspiration and revelation, and Dr. Dederin had made that one of the areas of his theological expertise. And so they asked him to come and explain the Adventist position. And one after another, before Dr. Dederin spoke, one after another, these learned theologians from all over the world would get up and read 30 or 40 pages in which they tried to explain this phenomenon of inspiration, revelation, how the prophet gets messages communicated to him or her from God. And then they asked Dr. Dederin to get up. And he told me this himself. He said, "I simply read Selected Messages, Book 1, pages 15 to 23. A very short, you can read it in maybe 20, 30 minutes. And the people there were astonished. They were charmed. They said, "We've never heard it explained in so few words. Did you write that?" And he said, "No, I can't claim authorship." Who did? He didn't want to tell him it was Ellen White. He knew that would create all kinds of questions. But they pressed him. And finally, he said, "That was written by Ellen White, who never finished the fourth grade of elementary school," and they couldn't believe it. It's simple. It's comprehensive. She says in there, it is not the words that are inspired. It was the men who were inspired and imbued with thoughts. But for people who believe that all the prophet does is take down dictation, literary assistance for a prophet, it just seems like an oxymoron. Well, there are others who said, well, okay, she only had, at the most, not 4 full years of primary school education. She was incapable of writing the books which bear her name as author. And of course, she had to have these helpers because they were the real authors of her book. And by the way, the critics along that line were aided and abetted by one of her literary helpers, a lady named Fanny Bolton. And I'm going to talk to you more about Fanny, so I won't get into that now. But Fanny was an interesting character, and she worked for Mrs. White for a while, both in the United States and in Australia. We'll talk about her experience, but she claimed that she herself wrote most of The Steps to Christ, most of that book, and several other books as well. We'll come back to her. But there were those who said that she was not the real author of the works attributed to her. The assumption of the third group category were that in her later years, and I was asked this question before we began this afternoon, in her later years, the lady was senile. And so if the lady was senile, and I'm going to demonstrate to you that the lady was far from senile, that she was senile, and so these literary helpers had to write this stuff and then put it out under Ellen White's name. Even in the later years, Ellen White was very much in charge. And we'll come back to this a little later, but I'll just make a couple of points here. Was very much in charge of her literary enterprise. For example, when the 50,000 copies of Great Controversy, which were first printed under that name in 1884, were sold out in 4 years, 50,000 copies, because now colporters are selling Great Controversy to the public. And so they sold 50,000 copies, and the printing plates were worn out, and they were going to have to make new printing plates. And Ellen White says, look, I'd like to do a little revising. And then she made some changes. She updated some of the language to be more contemporary, updated some of the sources. And then in 1911, she's now only 4 years away from her death at the age of 87. 1911, she wanted to update Great Controversy again. By 1911, a number of the historical sources that were quoted in the 1888 Great Controversy were no longer in print. And so she took W.W. Prescott, who was an interesting man. In fact, Gilbert Valentine wrote his doctoral dissertation on Prescott at Andrews University and popularized it in a book that they sold at the ABC, probably out of print now. And Prescott had the distinction in Adventist circles of being the only man ever to simultaneously be president of 3 colleges at the same time. Berrien Springs, which was then called Emmanuel Missionary College, Union College, and I think Walla Walla was the third one, only for a very short time. But Prescott did as he was asked, and he found, I think, close to 100 up-to-date historical citations to substitute in the 1911 edition for some that had appeared in the 1888 when those were no longer in print. The books were out of print. Ellen White wanted people to be able to verify what she had to say. So Prescott came with her, came to her with a big stack of suggested, and she looked at them, and she says, thank you, Brother Prescott. Then he kind of cleared his throat a little bit, and he said, there's some other things I have here for you, too. Prescott wanted to change some of the theology in Great Controversy. For example, on the 2300 days, he had a view somewhat different from the general view of the church. And of course, he thought that his view was the right view, and he wanted Ellen White to have the right view, which of course meant Prescott's view. And so, with tongue in cheek, he offered these to her. Now, mind you, this is 1911. This is 4 years before she died. She looked over the substituted historical statements, and she accepted every one of them. She looked over the suggested theological substitutions, and she rejected every one of them. The lady was very much in charge to her, practically to her dying day. She was not senile when she died. Well, before we get into talking about the literary helpers, who they were, what they did, what they were told to do, what they were prohibited, there were 2 things they were forbidden to do. We'll talk about that in a moment. I want to look at the Bible first. Whenever anybody raises a question with me about Ellen White, the very first thing I want to do is go to the Bible. You see, folks, and this is a crucial distinction. I want to see Ellen White in the light of the Bible. I do not want to see the Bible in the light of Ellen White. I hope this won't upset any of you. It's a crucial distinction. It's an important distinction. I want to see Ellen White in the light of the Bible. And when anybody comes to me with a question about Ellen White, the first thing I do is, hey, is there anything in the Bible that will help me with this? So, literary helpers for prophets, let's go first to the Bible. Do we find in the Scriptures incidents of prophets having literary helpers? And we do in both of the Old and the New Testaments. In the most prominent example in the Old Testament is the prophet Jeremiah, who had a scribe whose name was Baruch. And one of the interesting things about the book of Jeremiah, just a little side point to make, Jeremiah repeatedly used the expression, the word of the Lord, the word of the Lord, the word of the Lord came to me. In fact, in the very first chapter, verse 2, verse 4, verse 9, verse 14, verse 12, 14, 17, and on into the chapter, the word of the Lord came to me. So that's one of his trademarks, the word of the Lord. Now, his helper is named Baruch. And Baruch is mentioned in some detail in chapter 36, particularly of Jeremiah's book, verses 4 to 6, and then 17 and 18, then 27 and verse 32. Why did Baruch need a helper? There is a hint in the book of Jeremiah, twice in chapter 20, verse 2, and chapter 36, verse 5, Baruch says, I am shut up, which I think is a reference, an oblique reference to the fact that he was in prison. Incidentally, in chapter 36, which mentions Baruch, it also mentions that the people were asking both Jeremiah and Baruch about the specific nature of Baruch's work. Maybe they were concerned about a prophet who needed a literary helper. And the question was raised, how did you do it, Baruch? Our Bible commentary editors have suggested that the possible and probable role of Baruch was threefold. Possibly to transcribe oral dictation. Here's this man in jail, and so Baruch goes to his cell, and he dictates to Baruch. I don't know what kind of shorthand they used in those days. They probably didn't have the Gregg system, which is sometimes used today. But anyway, he probably transcribed oral dictation. Secondly, the Bible commentary editors have suggested that possibly he collected, edited, and preserved materials for the book of Jeremiah. And thirdly, he may have possibly contributed from his own research to biographical narratives in the book of Jeremiah. Who was this guy, Baruch? He is called a scribe, which tells us that he was probably pretty well educated. He came from a distinguished family in Judah, and scholars have researched that thing out and found out that Baruch's brother was Zedekiah's quartermaster and went with King Zedekiah into Babylonian exile. His high character and his substantial influence may be further inferred by two things. One, he was accused by one of the political parties in Jerusalem at the time of the invasion. There was one party who was saying, let's flee to Egypt and seek the protection of the Pharaoh of Egypt against the king of Babylon and so on, Assyria. And he was accused of prejudicing, influencing Jeremiah against their course. Well, it wasn't Baruch who influenced Jeremiah. It was the Lord told him that was a bad idea. And then later, there was a collection of spurious writings issued under Baruch's own name. In fact, one of them is called the Book of Baruch. He didn't write it, we're pretty sure. But today, that book is found in the Apocrypha to the Old Testament. So in the Old Testament, Jeremiah has a scribe, a literary helper, if you please, whose name is Baruch. In the New Testament, we have possibly three different New Testament writers who are believed to have used literary helpers, and Paul is the biggest example. In Romans 16:22, just a couple of verses before Paul says goodbye to the people in Rome to whom he is writing this letter, there is an interesting statement which says, I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle. Now, wait a minute. It's the epistle of Paul to the Romans, isn't it? Yes. Tertius was the writer, but he was not the author. And I'm making a distinction here that I hope you will make. He was the writer. He was the amanuensis. He was the scribe who wrote the book of Romans, but he was not the author of it. And after Paul finished what he had to say, Tertius took up the pen and sent a little personal message along to the members of the church at Rome who would be reading this. Hey, I, Tertius, am the one who did the writing of this document. In 1 Corinthians, the very first verse of the very first chapter, Paul mentions that he and Sosthenes are sending their greetings. And it is believed by many Bible scholars that Sosthenes was the literary helper for Paul in the writing of 1 Corinthians. When we come to Paul's second letter to Timothy, which is believed to be the last letter that he wrote before he was martyred, we find that Luke was the one to whom Paul dictated his message. And Ellen White herself supports that in Volume 4 of the Testimonies, page 353. She says, these words in 2 Timothy, dictated by Paul just prior to his death, were written down by Luke for our profit and warning. Now, why did Paul need any literary helpers? There are several reasons which are suggested today. First of all, perhaps the same reason that Baruch did. He was in jail a fair amount of time in the later years of his life, and so it may have been imprisonment that caused him, with its restrictions, it caused him to need a helper. Also, it is possible that Paul had bad eyesight. You remember in Corinthians, he says to the Christians in Corinth, he said, I have a thorn. He was using a metaphor. I have a thorn in the flesh. Many Bible scholars, in fact, I would guess almost maybe most Bible scholars, think that that thorn was bad eyesight, caused probably when Paul met the risen crucified Lord outside the gate of Damascus, and in all of that bright glory. You know, he was blind for about 3 days there when he stayed in the house of Ananias. And I can sure imagine that Ananias didn't want him as a house guest, this man who was murdering Christians all up and down the land, you know. But some believe that even though Paul regained his eyesight, he only regained a measure of it. And he is complaining, they believe, when he speaks about the thorn in the flesh. And he says, I prayed God 3 times. He probably told the Lord, look how much more good I could do for the cause and for the church if I had my full eyesight. And you know, I could do so much more work, and I could do better work. And I'm sure he figured out a lot of reasons why the Lord should remove this thorn. And after 3 times, the Lord said, shut up, Paul. Don't want to hear any more about it. My grace is sufficient for you. And that expression has been solace to a lot of other people who have had various kinds of thorns in the flesh and prayed the Lord to take them away. And the Lord didn't take them away, but promised, my grace is sufficient for you. It is also possible, and I never thought of this one until I read the Bible commentary where the editors suggest that there may have been a third necessity, and that was that Paul's hands were permanently injured in the beatings which he sustained. And he speaks in his various writings, 2 Corinthians 11, 24 to 27 particularly. He speaks about the torture and the beatings and all that he suffered as a missionary for Christ. And so maybe his hands couldn't hold a stylus against a papyrus scroll in order to write, because that's the way they wrote in those days. One thing is sure, it was not because Paul's limited facility in the Greek language. Now that probably may have been a factor in John and Peter needing a literary assistant. We'll come to John and Peter in just a minute. But Paul had no problem with the Greek language. Just as Moses was the highest educated in terms of what we think of as education today, degrees at a university sort of thing, just as Moses educated in the University of Cairo under the tutelage and under the sponsorship of the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, Paul was highly educated. He came from Tarsus. Do you remember what he said about Tarsus? He said, it's no mean city. Do you know why it was no mean city? It was a university town. And a few years ago, the archaeologists excavated Tarsus, and they found a library at the University of Tarsus that had 10,000 clay tablets. That's what they had for books. Wouldn't you like to check out a dozen books from the library? Clay tablets? It would break your back. Well, it is quite possible. I don't offer it as a proof. I can't prove it. But I, knowing Paul's thirst for knowledge, no question about that, I suspect that he may well have had a doctorate from the University of Tarsus before he ever went to Jerusalem. We do know where Paul got his education in Jerusalem. He was a student in the premier seminary of a man named Gamaliel. Thank you, Gamaliel. You know, Gamaliel was the one who said when they wanted to rope him into persecuting the Christians, he said, look, he says, if this thing's of man, it's going to peter out. They'd had a lot of other things that were of men that petered out. Barabbas was one of them. He was lucky. He got let go. But he said, if it's of God, you better be careful because you can't stop it. And furthermore, can you think of the implications of you fighting against God? Gamaliel was a wise man. And his seminary was considered the Harvard University or the Stanford University of Jerusalem at the time when Paul went to school there. So Paul didn't have any problems with the Greek language. But it is possible that Peter and John, and we don't know what kind of education they had. They may not have even gone to synagogue school. There was a synagogue in Capernaum. If you go to Capernaum today, you may see what I saw when I visited Capernaum on the edge of the Sea of Galilee. There is a first century synagogue there, and the report is, tradition is, that it was built by a Roman centurion out of gratitude to the Christians for their work. Who knows whether that's the centurion that was mentioned in the Gospels or not, but in Paul's writings, there are, in some of them, between the various epistles, there are certain stylistic differences, so much so that some people think that Paul wasn't the author of all of them. For example, the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, some think chapter 11, Hebrews, was a sermon by Paul. You know, you look at the structure of Hebrews 11. He starts out naming these people in this pantheon of faith, you know. He starts out and he names them, and then he gives you a paragraph about each one. And then he may have looked down, didn't look at his watch. They didn't have watches, but they had hourglasses. And the sands may have been going through rather rapidly through the hourglass, and he realized, hey, I don't have too much time. Anyway, the structure of Hebrews 11. All of a sudden, instead of a paragraph, he gives a sentence. And then a little farther down, he says, time would fail us, and then he just gives you a string of names. Hebrews 11 may have been a sermon. Anyway, there are differences, stylistic differences in some of Paul's. The rhetorical quality differs a little bit, but we distinguish that from inspired truth, which does not vary from book to book, letter to letter. Peter. 1 Peter, we are told in 1 Peter 5:12, Peter himself tells us that his secretary was Silas, or the Latin or derivative, Greek derivative, Silvanus. Silas was. And 1 Peter is the most polished form of Greek, probably in the whole New Testament. It's very literary and beautifully polished in Greek prose and everything. 2 Peter is, they don't believe the same man wrote the two books, because 2 Peter is such basic, primitive style, and 1 Peter is finely polished, 2 Peter crude in terms of Greek literary style, lacking in certain areas, not lacking in purity and truth, clarity and accuracy. And some have the idea that Silas, polished up the first letter that Paul wrote before it went out, polished it up into a very nice literary form, but that the second epistle of Peter, written in jail just before his crucifixion, his martyrdom, nobody was around, and so Peter did the best he could with limited education and limited knowledge of Greek. That wasn't his first language anyway. It was Aramaic up there, Sea of Galilee. Well, John, there is no evidence that John had a helper, but I discovered when I visited the island of Patmos a few years ago, I was talking to a guide. She was actually a Dominican nun. She was quite a lady, quite a feisty lady. She gathered all of these people who just got off the cruise ship. She gathered them around and she said, "How many of you are Roman Catholic?" And about half of the group raised their hands. And she said, "I'm Orthodox." The Orthodox Church never had a Reformation. You Catholics had to have a Reformation to clean you up. But we Orthodox never had a Reformation, you know. Well, that got her off to a good start with these Roman Catholic people there. Anyway, this is what she said. In the list of the seven deacons, which are mentioned in early chapter in the book of Acts, and by the way, of those seven, the only one whose name appears again is Stephen, and he doesn't hang around long because he's martyred. But of those seven deacons, the first seven, one of the six who are named, but nothing is said about them, is a man with the Greek name of Prochorus. And it is a tradition in the Greek Orthodox Church that Prochorus volunteered to share John's exile on the island of Patmos, and that John probably had his visions and saw these things and then dictated them to Prochorus, who then wrote them down in a scroll, and then they were preserved later on. And finally, when books were made, they became in movable type, Gutenberg's invention. They came in that fashion. Well, my whole point in talking about this Bible writers using literary helpers is that if the Bible writers did use them, and they did, then it may not be such a big deal if Ellen White used literary helpers. Now, why? Why may Ellen White have needed outside literary assistance? I have suggested and will suggest four categories of limitations. First of all, limitations arising from a lack of formal education. There are people who say Ellen White was not educated. That can only be considered a true statement in the narrowest definition of education being X number of hours sitting in a formal classroom situation listening to a teacher. In that sense, no, it could be said Ellen White was not educated. But I think that there are probably at least four sources of what I would call her real education. First of all, she read widely. Her personal library had in it somewhere between 800 and 1,300 books at the time she died. The White Estate still has about 25% of those original books. We also have an inventory of what books, title and author and so on. And so we have bought from secondhand bookstores copies. They're not the ones she had, and they're kept separately from the ones she had. But if you go to those books that we still have that she had, you open them up. There's underlining here and there, notes in the margin, notes on the fly leaves of the back and front part of the book that were not printed upon. And it's very evident that Ellen White read widely. And, of course, Abraham Lincoln immediately comes to mind as one man who got educated largely by reading by firelight. A second of her four sources of what I call her real education was extensive travel. Ellen White traveled back and forth the North American continent repeatedly during the years of her ministry. She also spent 2 years in Europe, 1885 to 87, and certainly that was an education. She visited Waldensian country, things that she had seen in vision, and now she is actually seeing them. She spent 2 years in Europe, 1885 to 87, and then 1891 to 1900, she spent 9 years in the South Pacific, most of it in either New Zealand or Australia, but she also visited a number of the islands of the South Pacific, largely going and coming. And travel can be very educational. I can testify to that from my own personal experience. My last 12 years plus of salaried service to the church was in the White Estate, where we were obligated to travel all over the world. My work was largely in theological education, And I think the latest yearbook lists about 99 institutions of higher learning around the world operated by our church, and I had the privilege of teaching on the campuses of 33 of them. And it was a wonderful experience. When I was in South America in Peru, I had an opportunity to expand my interest in Inca culture. I had an opportunity to travel at some risk, because that was at the time terrorists, Flaming Light or Shining Light, I think they were called, Shining Path, these terrorists were shooting people. In fact, they told me, this train that I took to Machu Picchu, they said, you sit in a middle coach. Don't sit in a front coach. Don't sit in a back coach. Sit in a middle coach. Don't sit near a window. And don't obviously look like an American tourist for your own good. Man, I followed that to the letter, and I didn't get shot at. But if you're interested in Inca culture, man, that was a wonderful opportunity for me to indulge an interest that I had in Inca culture. And we saw the famous Iguazu Falls in South America. We saw Victoria Falls in Africa. These are magnificent things. Really, Niagara Falls doesn't begin to compare with some of them. So travel can be a wonderful educator, and this was one of the fringe benefits that I thoroughly enjoyed in my work in the White Estate. Third source of her real education: close association with highly educated people. Ellen White had a reservoir of very well-educated people to whom she could come and ask questions, pick their brains, to use the common expression. There was John Harvey Kellogg, medical doctor. And John Harvey Kellogg was much better known in the last part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, much better known in North America and outside than Ellen White by far. She was a co-founder of the church, but Kellogg was the one who was really known by the public, and he was well-educated, and she could pick his brain. She did. J.N. Andrews. J.N. Andrews could do something I can't do. J.N. Andrews could read the Hebrew of the Old Testament in the original, and he could read the Greek of the New Testament in the original, and he could tell you what the writer originally said in their own language. I would like to do that, but my training was not along those lines. So she could pick the brains of educated, highly educated people. Prescott there, president of three colleges at one time, and so on. But the fourth cause of her real education: I had 16 years of education, 18, I guess, formal education. I'd trade all of it for one-tenth of this. She had 2,000 conversations, dreams, visions, in which she talked, and many of them talked with either Jesus or the angel Gabriel. Man, that's an education in itself. She was not an uneducated person. Okay? Approximately 2,000 dreams and visions, many of them held converse with Jesus and Gabriel. Now, there were genuine limitations in her background, which arose from a limited formal education, less than 4 grades of elementary school. She had a limited vocabulary. Now, wide reading eventually eliminated that, but in the early days, you look at early writings, which is aptly titled, and you'll find a paragraph starts on one page and continues over on a second page and may continue on into a third page, and those sentences are compound, complex, compound, complex, compound, complex. Man, her literary style in her earliest writings is very crude. Not the truth. The truth is beautiful. The truth stands out. But the vehicle, you know, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. The earthen vessel, to use Paul's metaphor, created some problems. Okay, she had a limited vocabulary. She had very irregular grammar and syntax. Wide reading would eventually pretty much polish that up. At the very beginning, she had a rather elementary rhetorical style, and there were technical deficiencies. For example, spelling. Ellen White couldn't spell for beans. Well, she only had less than four full grades of education. Spelling. Punctuation. She couldn't punctuate a sentence very well. Capitalization. You know, technical things. Then there were limitations from writing rapidly. When she came out of vision, she wrote as fast as she could, wanting to get it all down before she forgot any of it. And you read the original first draft of some of that stuff when she came out of vision. I mean, it's stream of consciousness kind of stuff. And then later she would polish it up. Then she would hand it to one of her literary helpers, who then would try to do a little more. And And over here, we have indicated the role of those literary assistants. First of all, she had clerical help, and then she had book editorial help. These were paid for by herself from her royalties. Now, in her day, authors were responsible for much more than they are today. When I wrote the manuscript for my first book, which incidentally is still over there in the ABC, it's called A Gift of Light, 63-page paperback, I just wrote the manuscript, put my footnotes in, sent it up to the review, and one day while I was working at the General Conference, two men showed up. I thought they were from the FBI at first. They came. They said, "We've come to investigate." Investigate what? Investigate your manuscript, Brother Kuhn. We're going to find out whether your footnotes are right or not, whether the people you said this actually said it. And they checked every one of my footnotes. They checked every one of my sources. And then back up at the review, they had copy editors and they had proofreaders. Then they went over the thing with a fine-tooth comb. I came out fairly well, I think. Certainly as far as the footnotes and the source citations and so on were concerned. But in Ellen White's day, that work that today is done by publishers in their shop had to be done by the writer. And so the royalties in her day were much substantially larger than they are today. In fact, folks, today it is almost impossible to make a living by writing for our publishing houses. And I don't say this in any sort of a critical sense, but the royalty, unless you write one of these year-end devotional books, the Morning Watch type book, which may sell 20 or 30,000 copies, unless you do that, your royalties, well, you might be able to take your wife out to dinner for 3 or 4 times a month. Anyway, in her day, the royalties were greater because the work expected of an author was greater. So she had to have these helpers, and she had clerical help who did typing. Now, I did a little research. Who invented the typewriter? Well, it's a man whose name you've never heard of, but it was bought by the Remington Gun Company, and Remington brought out the first commercial typewriter in the year 1874. Well, this is just about the time Ellen White is beginning to get into high gear in her writing program. She heard about typewriters, and she said, hey, you know, Ellen White was progressive. She said, listen, we need to get, probably bought a half a dozen of them for her helpers. She had anywhere from 6 to 12 helpers at any one time. They came and left. And yet, interestingly, another evidence that Ellen White was the real author, the style of Ellen White, it evolved. It evolved. But people who are informed on literary style and the characteristics of literary style can tell you and can prove to you that Ellen White was the author. And by the way, Ellen White never used a typewriter. Now, when I came out of college, I used a typewriter to prepare my sermons. Later on, years later, I got an electric typewriter. And in my old age, I got a computer. They say old dogs can't learn new tricks, but old coons can learn some new tricks. So I finally learned, and I tell you, once I learned to use the computer, I wondered, how on earth did I ever write anything out? Because you can edit the thing as you go along. How did I ever, with a typewriter, you can't do any editing as you go along. Takes you forever to get anything done. You know, if Ellen White had had a computer and a photocopy machine, I'll leave out the fax machine for the moment, just a computer and a photocopy machine, she wouldn't have needed half of the helpers that she had. But anyway, they got typewriters, and they had clerical help. And there were people who had to type out the first-hand, handwritten draft. And by the way, I'm glad that Ellen White never used a typewriter herself. If she had used a typewriter today, we wouldn't know whether she wrote it or whether she didn't write it, if it's a typewriter. Incidentally, there was not only evolution of her literary style, but there was evolution of her handwriting. I still have in my files lecture notes from courses that I took in college, 1944 to 48. That was before the flood, you understand. And I look at my handwriting as a young college student, and I look at it today, and I wouldn't believe it was the same person. Arthur White, her grandson, who for 42 years was secretary of the White estate, Arthur White had worked with those original manuscripts so much that he would really wow visitors to the White estate. They would come, get a tour of the office, and he'd pull open a drawer of letters and ask the person to pick out one, lay it on the table, put their hand over the date at the top of page one, and he would look at it, and he could tell you within 2 years the year that she wrote. Her handwriting evolved, but he was so familiar with her handwriting. I'm glad she never used a typewriter. I'm glad she never used a computer with a printer. Okay, so clerical help did a lot of typing. The first handwritten draft, then subsequent edited drafts, and then there were multiple copies of correspondence. She might write a letter to three people, but want to send it to six more, and of course they had to make copies and more copies. They sometimes used carbon paper. That was available in her day, but you know, after you get about four or five carbon papers, the stuff's almost illegible underneath. Then there were the book editors, and they corrected grammatical errors. They eliminated unnecessary repetition. Now, a certain amount of repetition is very useful rhetorically to make a point. And preachers and public speakers are taught in the classes in which they are taught how to preach and how to speak, are taught that a certain limited amount of repetition is desirable. But Ellen White repeated and repeated and repeated ad nauseum, forgive the expression, and they needed to eliminate unnecessary repetition from her writings. Then they did clarification of expressed statements which seemed to indicate that what she wrote was vague. And one of her helpers would say, "Mrs. White, this sentence really, I'm not sure what you're trying to say here. Are you trying to say this or trying to say that?" And the helper might even suggest a better way to say it. And Ellen White would listen to her, and sometimes she would say, "Yes, yes, you have phrased it better than I." There were times when she said, "No way. You did not phrase it what I intended to say. Maybe we can improve it, but what you said isn't." She was very much in charge of her literary operation. Clarification of expressed ideas which were deemed to be vague. Internal transpositions of sentences and paragraphs for a better order of arrangement. After Ellen White wrote it out, "Well, look, if we put this sentence up here, the logic would flow a little better," and so on. She would agree to that. Then there was external transpositions, which was done only by senior staff, and that's when they might even bring a chapter from one book over into another manuscript say, "You know, this would really, really fit well here," and Ellen White would decide if it would or if it wouldn't. And then lastly, the preparation of a book index. Now, her literary helpers were absolutely told, instructed in very clear and unambiguous language, that there were two things they must never do, no-nos. Number one, they were never to change the meaning of anything that Ellen White had ever written. Secondly, they were forbidden to add any new ideas which originated with the staff. And the last step in the preparation of a book manuscript before it went to the printer was Ellen White's reading everything that was there and her signature at the bottom of each page, so that the typesetter at the Pacific Press or the Review and Herald or Battle Creek Publishing House in the earliest days, that they knew that this was Ellen White's own words, even though they were now in typewritten form. She put her signature at the bottom of each page. All right. There were limitations arising from writing rapidly. It was often stream of consciousness sort of thing. There were also limitations arising from the mind being weary or oppressed from a heavy burden of anxiety. Ellen White was a people person, and she cared deeply about people and their individual problems, and these concerns often weighed her down. Lastly, there were limitations arising from attempting to portray difficult and complex material, because some theological concepts are a bit difficult to express in words. And in her diary, entries for January 10 and January 11 in the year 1873, and in a letter that she wrote in 1874, exhibit the anxiety and the frustrations of her personal feelings of inadequacy. Who were her helpers? Well, her earliest helper was her husband, James. Now, James was well-educated in terms of education of that particular day and was sort of a literary person and had a knack for it. And from the 1840s to the 1860s, he was largely her only helper. He was a trained schoolteacher and made his living for a while that way. And he helped her especially in preparing Spiritual Gifts, books 1, 2, 3, and 4, her first series of books that were written in 1858 to 1864. Ellen White would write out her thoughts at the kitchen table during the daytime while James was engaged in pastoral or evangelistic work. And then he would come home at night. They didn't have electricity. They had candles. And they'd light a candle and put it on the kitchen table. And then she and he would sit there together, and he would edit her manuscript, and he would take out the unnecessary repetition, correct some of the spelling and syntax. Some of the syntax was spelled S-I-N-T-A-X. And he would help her in that particular way, correct grammatical errors and eliminate the needless and excessive repetition. Ellen White, in commenting on her husband's work, one time said that she did not regard his judgment as infallible or his words as inspired. James White was not an inspired prophet. But, she said, I have ever believed him to be better qualified for this work than any one of our other preachers, for two reasons. First, his long experience, and second, I have seen he was especially called and adapted to the work. One time, Ellen White was visited by the angel Gabriel and told what God's plan was for her husband and for her two sons who survived. She bore four male children. The oldest one died at 16 from erysipelas. The youngest one died, I think, before he reached the age of 1 year. The two middle ones, Edson was the older one, and Willie, William C. White, but everybody called him Willie, including his mother. Willie was a bit younger. And even though Willie was the younger of the two surviving sons, he was the one chosen by God to take his father's place in 1881 when his father died at the age of 61, a young man still, died from overwork. And she talked to him about it a lot. She says, you're overworking. But James White was a perfectionist, and he felt that nobody could do things quite like he could, and he had a hard time delegating. And, well, I can't say too much because that's one of the things I've been cursed with, too. I want to make everything just as perfect as I can, and sometimes I waste a lot of time. J.N. Andrews was the same. She told J.N. Andrews one time he would write something out for the Review and Herald, and then he would revise it 7 or 8 times. She says, Andrews, get that thing in print. She says, we can't wait around for you to gussy it up. She wanted to get the message out, and Andrews was a perfectionist too. Anyway, the work of James White and her two sons was outlined to her in vision by the angel Gabriel, and the angel said that God had especially qualified James for that particular aspect of his work. There was another family member in the extended family, a niece, the daughter of Carolyn Harmon, who later married a man named Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H. I used to pronounce it Clough, but I'm told it's Clough, pronounced Clough. Ellen White had 7 brothers and sisters. There were 8 Harmon children. Only 3 of the Harmon children became Seventh-day Adventists. Her sister, Sarah, and her brother, Robert Harmon Jr., and Ellen. Ellen had a fraternal twin sister, Lizzie or Elizabeth, and the sister was probably the only one still at home when Ellen had her first visions. One would have thought that surely Elizabeth, of all the siblings, would have become a Seventh-day Adventist, but she didn't. She married a grocer named Mr. Boggs and continued to live in Portland, Maine for a number of years and died there in the 1890s. Ellen White kept in touch with her, sent them copies of her writing, sent them the Review and Herald and the Signs of the Times for missionary purposes. She had a burden. Her oldest sister was Carolyn, who married a Methodist minister by the name of Clough. Carolyn had a daughter named Mary Clough, and the Harmon family had certain genes that tended toward literary ability in it. I mean, her own son, Edson, did some writing of a fairly respectable nature, and there were others in the family who did some writing. And Carolyn, daughter Mary Clough, was quite a good writer. And so Ellen hired Mary for 2 reasons, aside from the fact that she needed a helper. And Carolyn only worked for her just a little over a year or so. Ellen wanted to see Carolyn, her sister, wanted to see Carolyn become a Seventh-day Adventist. She wrote to her sister, her older sister, Carolyn. She wrote to her one time about the importance of the Sabbath. And we have Carolyn's reply. And she says, I think you are making too much of this Sabbath thing. And she says, I think I'll take my chances with Jesus on the Sabbath. And of course, Ellen was horrified and kept writing. And I think she saw in Mary, Carolyn's daughter, an opportunity for Mary maybe to become an Adventist. And if Mary did become an Adventist, she would have influence maybe more than Ellen on her mother. She carried a burden for the non-Adventist members of her family. And in 1876 and 1877, she employed Mary. But Mary did not have nor adopt the Adventist lifestyle, and she was going out Friday nights doing things that weren't proper from an Adventist point of view. And so finally, she was exerting an influence that was unfavorable, and she soon became more of a liability than an asset, and so Ellen just sent her back home. Mentioned Edson a moment ago, particularly in the 1890s, 1895, 1896. Edson did evangelistic work among the freed ex-slaves in the southern United States for many years, and he had a burden for these. And he took Desire of Ages, certain chapters, and he rewrote them in simple language because, remembered, even when the slaves were freed, they weren't educated. They had a very limited, probably a maximum 400 to 600 word vocabulary. And so Edson rewrote those several chapters. And later on, Marion Davis came along and helped Edson to polish those up. And they are available. It's a children's Desire of Ages is what it is. And the book is in print today, probably over here, available in your ABC. She had an in-house salaried staff. I mentioned that the helpers came and went. Some of them stayed a while. Marion Davis was there for about 25 years or so. She was her most significant literary helper and the one who helped her put Desire of Ages together. And I use that expression, put it together advisedly, because Ellen White did not write Desire of Ages chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4. She called the project the Life of Christ Project, and she asked Marion Davis, who I am totally satisfied had a photographic memory. You know, the Bible says you can covet the best gifts. I covet a photographic memory. My memory has never been all that great, and the older I get, the worse it gets. And Marion Davis could remember what Ellen White had written about Christ in many different letters, articles for the magazines, book chapters, and correspondence and everything. And she prepared 30 scrapbooks. And she would go to the files and take and just cut out, make copies, of course, statements and put them in these 30 scrapbooks. And then she and Ellen would take all of this body of material, this corpus of material, as the scholars in literary circles would call it, and they would put it in chronological sequence, beginning with Bethlehem and ending with the Ascension on the Mount of Olives. And then Ellen would look at this big, vast array of material, and she would see gaps. And so she would write something to fill this gap and write something to fill this gap. And then she would, as she looked at it, she would see that maybe she had 4 or 5 pages on this particular narrative of the Gospels. And she would say to Marion, I just had a vision on that. And so she would go back and write 13 or 14 pages to replace these 3 or 4 from an earlier writing. And so that's the way the thing grew by accretion. When it was almost ready to go to the publishers, they realized that they had far too much for one book. Desire of Ages has more than 800 pages, just Desire of Ages. And what they realized was that they were going to have to take some of this from the Life of Christ Project and put it into 2 other books. Mount of Blessings was her extended commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. Now, there's a chapter in Desire of Ages on the Sermon on the Mount, but her extended commentary was taken out of this corpus of materials and put over here as a separate book manuscript. And then the parables. Now, there are some things on the parables in Desire of Ages, but most of her stuff on the parables was siphoned off and put over here in a book called Christ Object Lessons. And then, and only then, Ellen White did not always write her books a chapter 1, a chapter 2, a chapter 3, like most people write books today. Many of these things were compilations which she developed and superintended herself. Well, I promised to tell you a little bit about Fanny Bolton. And I do want to take a few minutes today to try to answer questions because we didn't do that either Monday or Tuesday. Fanny Bolton came to work for Ellen White. She had been a newspaper reporter, was an Adventist convert, I guess, and she came to work for Ellen White in 1887. Fanny was 28 and Ellen was 60 at the time, and she became one of Mrs. White's corps of literary assistants. She early gave evidence of both emotional instability and spiritual immaturity, but Ellen overlooked it and took her on anyway, perhaps later would come to regret not paying more attention to those two problems. But despite this early evidence of emotional instability and spiritual immaturity, she took Fanny Bolton with her, Frances E. Bolton, who was known as Fanny, to Australia in 1891. In 1891, from 1891, the next 5 years, 1896, Fanny, first of all, was having terrible headaches, and this turned out to be physiologically significant. She was having terrible migraine headaches, and quite frankly, in total candor, she was on an ego trip. And she began to say to some of the people privately, you know, Sister White is not giving these literary helpers of her literary staff, adequate or public credit. She says nothing about us. She acts like we weren't even here, but she couldn't get along without us. And she began talking along that line. There were those who were critics of Ellen White in Australia at the time who were just looking for little juicy pieces of morsel, you know, to use against Mrs. White. And that which started out being public, a private murmuring, suddenly became quite public. And Fanny, even at one point, claimed that she had written most of the book Steps to Christ, and Ellen White just put her name on it. Well, there's evidence that she didn't, because there's evidence from Ellen White's manuscripts and letters, which contained materials that wound up in Steps to Christ, that Ellen White was indeed the author of all of that book. But anyway, Fanny started out, and then Ellen said to her, Fanny, you know this isn't true. This isn't true. Maybe your headaches are partly to blame for this. I think they were. And so she said, you know, you can't work for me if you're going to be undercutting, undermining me. And Fanny would say, I'm sorry, and would write out a confession saying what she had done that was wrong and give it to Mrs. White. And Mrs. White took it and accepted it and kept her there. And then the next year, the thing would happen again. There were five times in the 5 years that Fanny was in Australia with Ellen White. And each time she would come back and confess in writing what she had done. And one time, she even wrote a document stating the truth of what the role of the literary workers was. Now, the critics of Ellen White today love to pick up on Fanny's accusations, but they are as silent as the grave on the written confessions, which they still have in the White Estate Vault. And so finally, the thing became so bad that they had to send Fanny back to the United States. Her health broke down completely, and they sent her back to the United States in 1896. So that was a problem that Ellen had to deal with. And when she went back to the United States, she settled in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And twice, for a period of 16 and a half months combined, once was, I think, 12 and a half months, and then 3 or 4 months, in the years 1911, February 20, 1911 to March 18 of 1912, so that's just a little over a whole year, and then October 9 of 1924 to January 21 of 1925, she was placed in the Kalamazoo State Hospital, which was a hospital for the mentally ill, and we have documented evidence, certified evidence, from the state superintendent of the hospital that she was there at that time and treated for a mental illness. So her headaches probably did play a part in her aberrations. But anyway, her credibility is seriously impaired by the fact of her hospitalization for the mentally ill. Well, there's a lot more, but it's 3 o'clock. I've got 15 minutes, and I did promise to try to provide some time for questions. And so let's drop this at this point. Tomorrow we're going to talk about inerrancy and infallibility. Does a true prophet ever make a mistake? Does a true prophet ever have to go back and change something? Do the predictions of a true prophet come to pass 100% of the time? And of all of the five presentations that I make, this one may be a little difficult for some of you who may have some pre-existing ideas on the nature of the more sureness of the prophetic word. And I'm going to suggest two different models tomorrow to explain the quintessential essence of the more sureness. Peter says we have a more sure word of prophecy. Okay, how is it more sure than the word of a non-prophet? And there are at least two views, and we're going to examine both of them tomorrow. You'll find both views within Adventism. In fact, I used to believe the first one, which I call the straitjacket theory. It is a theory of prevention. The Holy Spirit wraps a straitjacket, metaphorically, around the prophet to the point where the prophet couldn't make a mistake if the prophet wanted to. Not that the prophet would want to, but the prophet is precluded from making any mistake. And the other is called the correction theory, in which if the prophet makes a mistake that's important enough, the Holy Spirit does for the prophet what he doesn't do for you and me and moves in, usually immediately, to correct the mistake so there's no permanent damage done. And we'll give you examples from Scripture and also examples from the experience of Ellen Hoyt to go along with that. That's for tomorrow. I hope I've enticed you to want to come back. Okay, questions. Now, you'll have to speak loudly. I must confess to you that I have an acute hearing loss. I have two $2,000 hearing aids in my ears, and they don't work very well. And yesterday, one of them conked out in the 6:30 meeting, and the other one started to malfunction. And I had to miss some of the meetings here and go 30 miles south of here to an audiologist to get my hearing aids repaired. So you will need to speak loudly and perhaps slowly and clearly so that I can hear. My wife accuses me of answering questions people don't ask. Question.
Penny Bolton, who wrote for Ellen White, she has the number of songs in the Adventist church hymnal.
One.
Just one?
Yeah, just one.
Well, there's F.B. Bolton, and there's also a Fanny Bolton.
Well, maybe there's more than one. I've only found one. Do you know the one that's there is called Not I But Christ. I hope I haven't spoiled that song for you.
No.
Yeah, that's the only one I know. I'll have to check up on that. You may be right.
In the index where the authors are at, there's a 8 or 10 for Bolton in there. I ain't quite sure if they're all for Fanny Bolton or F.E. Bolton.
No, F.E. Belden.
Belden. Bolton.
No, no. The reason I'm so much aware of that, I'm talking to the ministers in their meeting at 8:30 tomorrow morning about Frank Belden, who was a nephew of Ellen White. His mother was Ellen's older sister, Sarah, one of the three Harmon's children that became Seventh-day Adventist. No, it's F.E. Belden, Franklin E. Belden, and Francis E. They had the same initials. Yeah. Okay. No, as far as I know, she did write a number of poems, and some of them were published in the secular press. But she was quite a literary lady, but she just had these problems, and she had this mental illness, which tragically affected.
Are you familiar with a gentleman named Vern Bates who made some claims that their original writings were changed over the years?
I'm not familiar with Vern Bates, who made the charge that writings were changed. Writings were edited. I mentioned a little bit about Great Controversy. When she updated Great Controversy in 1911, the first version was written in the 1800s and then 1900s. And so when she had previously said a century ago, she now says two centuries ago, you see. And she updated time elements. She also changed in Great Controversy, changed some of the historical statements to update them to present materials that were currently in print. But remember, the literary helpers, Ellen White totally superintended the editing processes, and her helpers were forbidden to change the meaning of anything and to add new ideas. Now, with Great Controversy, some people love to trot this out. 3.5 pages of the original Great Controversy were removed when it was revised in, I think, in the 1888 or the 1911 editions, because 1888. Because Ellen White herself said that there are some things I have written that are for our people that aren't meet in due season for non-Adventists. And when they discovered that cow porters could sell Great Controversy, then there were 3.5 pages in the chapter entitled Snares of Satan. This was not material thrown away. It was simply incorporated into Testimonies to Ministers. It's still in print. But the burden of proof is on people like Mr. Bates to demonstrate where this is. So, but I'm not familiar with his criticism. No, I'm not aware of any book that was recalled. It was suggested that her book, Sketches from the Life of Paul, was so similar in many places to Coney Barrenhausen's book on Paul that she was going to be threatened. We talked yesterday about plagiarism and lawsuits and everything, and it has been alleged that that she recalled Sketches from the Life of Paul, but she didn't, and you can still buy facsimile print copies of the book. Her book on counsels to mothers, that's not the exact title of it, and I can't think of it at the moment, but I don't think it was recalled. She had quite a bit to say about child raising and about various aspects of bringing up children and so on, and also she had a lot to say about sexuality, which some people today kind of roll their eyes at. We talked about masturbation yesterday. And that was one of the areas in which she had something to say. And in the day in which she said it, everybody agreed with her. But of course, today, you'll find very few behavioral scientists or family counselors that would go along with what she had, even in the Adventist church, go along with that. I'm not aware of any book being recalled. All right? Yes?
Ellen White wrote, "How the Lord rebuked her for giving out wrong information." Can you comment on that
story? I don't think it was wrong information. The connotation of that expression, I don't think, is accurate. Let me say what the Lord did rebuke her for. As I mentioned a moment ago, Ellen White was a people person, and she didn't want to hurt people's feelings. And sometimes the Lord would give her a strong testimony to bear to somebody, and she kind of softened it down a little bit. It wasn't wrong information. It was just kind of softened down a little bit. And the Lord rebuked her. In fact, the Lord scowled at her and then turned his back on her. Can you imagine how she reacted to that? I mean, she absolutely devastated. And she promised the Lord that she wouldn't soften, or, as we would say, water down that kind of counsel. No, she, in her earlier days, she was sensitive to the feelings of others, didn't want to hurt feelings, and so she kind of softened it a little bit. But the Lord took care of that very early in her experience. Yes. Daniel chapter 10 is probably the best single place in Scripture to find the characteristics of physical phenomena. When a prophet is in a vision state, now we differentiate between a vision and a dream. There is no evidence that when Ellen White had the prophetic dreams of the night, she had this physical phenomena. But in the prophetic visions of the day, what the Bible calls the open visions of the day, in those she would have her eyes open, but not aware of her immediate surroundings. She did not breathe. Her heart continued to function. The circulation system continued functioning normally. The lungs did not. And incidentally, there's an interesting thing in connection with that. The word inspiration in your King James Bible, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God, that word appears only once in the Scriptures. And the Greek word is theopneusis, which is a contraction of two Greek words, theos and pneuma. Theos, God, pneuma, breath. When we say that all Scripture is inspired, we are saying it is God-breathed. And there is a certain element of literal truth in that, because when the prophet is in vision, the prophet doesn't breathe and God breathes for the prophet. Heart continues to function. And by the way, there was a spiritualist physician who heard about Ellen White in the vision state. There's a loss of natural strength. There is an infusion of supernatural strength. And by the way, Ellen White in vision on a number of occasions, and there is documentation for this, because this has been poo-pooed. She held an extremely heavy family Bible, 14 pounds in weight. I can't even hold my arm out with nothing on it for 15 or 20 minutes. And she held a large quarto-size family Bible, a heavy family Bible in her hand, outstretched hand, unsupported outstretched hand for a number of minutes, extremely long period of time. It was supernatural. When she was in vision, James would invite people to come up, and if she was gesturing, you know, her hand was up like this, he would ask them to take her wrist and try to pull the hand down. And, you know, when you're holding it like this, you aren't. There's not much to support it. And yet, grown men would try to pull her hand down and would not be able to do so when she was in vision. So these were the characteristics. Well, this spiritualist physician in a little town about 40 miles south of Battle Creek, he heard about her vision and the physical phenomena, and he said, "Oh, I'm a hypnotist. That's hypnosis. She couldn't have a vision in my presence." Well, one day, and it was the dedication of the first legally organized Seventh-day Adventist Church. This was in 1860. And it happened to be exactly 3 months to the day before the first firing on Fort Sumter started. Technically, that's the beginning of the Civil War in the United States. 3 months before the Civil War began. She was having a vision in this church. They were dedicating it in the afternoon, and somebody remembered what this doctor had said, that he could bring her out of vision. So they went and got her, and he came, and he bustled down. She happened to be lying supine on the floor at the time, and he said, "Where is the patient?" And they showed him, and he went, and he knelt down, and he stood up, and in panic, he said, "She is not breathing." People who are in a hypnotic state breathe. She was not breathing. And he said, "She doesn't breathe." And they said, "Well, what is it?" He says, "I don't know, but let me out of here." And he wanted to head for the door. And there was a deacon standing there. And in that church, the doors opened inward. Fire marshal never permitted today. And the deacon planted his foot against the door and wouldn't allow him to open until the doctor told them what it was. And he said, "I don't know what it is, but she doesn't breathe. Let me out of here." And so they opened the door and let him go. We did not in early days, we do not today, use physical phenomena as proof of the authenticity of a vision. We use it as evidence. I'm drawing a distinction here clearly between evidence and proof. It is evident that something is going on supernaturally, but it doesn't qualify it as either supernatural in terms of God or supernatural in terms of Satan. Satan can counterfeit physical phenomena, and he does. And so this was the point that A.G. Daniels was making at the 1919 Bible conference, in which he said, "Well, I don't know whether she held a big Bible or not." Well, of course, the last of the big Bibles that she held was 10 years before he was born, so obviously he'd never seen it. He said, "I've never seen it. I don't know whether it's true or not." And he seems to be poo-pooing, and he said, "We don't make a big thing about physical phenomena." Well, the point he was making was, we don't use that as proof that it's from God. We use it as evidence that it is supernatural, but there are two supernatural powers in the world. And so we've never used physical phenomena as a proof of authenticity of something from God, because Satan can and does counterfeit. Oh, yes, the heart continues to function. I'm sorry? No, the lungs do not function, but the heart does function. The lungs are absolutely inert, but the heart does continue to function. Daniel chapter 10 is the best single chapter in the whole Bible to give you a little catalog of the characteristics of physical phenomena of a prophet in vision. Eyes open, but unaware of their immediate surroundings. Her longest vision was in February of 1845, if I'm not mistaken, down in Randolph, Massachusetts. She was in vision there from 1 o'clock until the sun went down, which was about 5 o'clock at that time of year. She was in vision approximately 4 hours. That's the longest known vision. The shortest vision was one time in family worship. And the only way they knew, it was about 30 seconds, and the only way they knew that she had a vision was that she stopped talking while she was praying. And she stopped talking for about 30 seconds, and then she picked up with her prayer and went on. It took her 2 weeks to write out everything she was shown in that 30-second vision right there during family worship. Incidentally, William E. Foy, who was the first person called to the prophetic office in 1842, Ellen White, I say it respectfully, was God's third choice. William E. Foy, a mulatto, a man of mixed racial origins, William Foy was God's first choice, a man of color. God is no respecter of persons. Hazen Foss, Ellen White's brother-in-law, her sister Mary, a non-Adventist, was married to a Samuel Foss, who happened to be the brother to Hazen Foss. And Hazen Foss, when William Foy quit giving the message, God came to Hazen Foss, and he refused to give the message, and then he came to Ellen Harmon. She was God's third choice, I say it respectfully. William Foy had two visions in 1842, one in January and one in February. The January vision lasted for 2.5 hours. Both of them were evening time and were in church services. The second vision in February of 1842 lasted 12.5 hours. If he went into vision at 8:30 at night, he didn't come out until 9 o'clock the next morning. And there were people who stayed there all night to see what had happened. He obviously wasn't dead because his heart was still beating. He had a pulse, but he wasn't breathing. And William Foy wrote out his first two visions, and they were published. And later on, when Ellen White saw it, she says, that essentially is what God showed me among my first visions. William Foy did not continue. He felt that there were problems. There was race prejudice in New England. I mean, as far north as New England in the 1840s, race prejudice is a terrible thing, and it had even penetrated New England. There were people prejudiced against him because of his racial origin. There were people who were prejudiced against him and against Ellen because of what a man named Joseph Smith was doing in Nauvoo, Illinois. Joseph Smith called himself prophet, seer, and revelator. Ellen White never called herself a prophet, and she had two reasons. Her work involved more than a prophet much more than we generally associate with a prophet. I had an article in the Adventist Review several years back on this. She never called herself a prophet. She says, others may call me that, and I have no argument. She never disclaimed the role, but she never claimed the title, because she said, my work is of a different nature, and my work involves much more than... Most people associate fortune-telling, predicting the future with a prophet. And she says, my work involves much more than that. But in 1844 was an election, a presidential election year, and in the spring of 1844, Joseph Smith said, I'm going to run for president. He was a polygamist, and he had multiple wives, and people wondered which wife would be the hostess in the White House if he got elected. And that, incidentally, that led to his being imprisoned, and finally he was assassinated, terrible blot on religious liberty in the United States. But Ellen White never claimed the title, but she never disclaimed the role. Well, I've run over 3 minutes. I promise never to do it again until the next time. Let's just have a word of prayer before we close. Father in heaven, thank you for this marvelous gift that you've given to our church. Help us to treasure it as we should. Help us to study it. Help us to read and study and understand, and help us to live by the counsels that you have given, and help us to share it with others. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.